Okay, and so the way we're going to do this is we're just going to ask questions, some of them to the panel. Some questions may be to specific members, but panelists should feel free to intervene as you feel moved. And after each question, we'll have sort of discussion from the floor, and then we'll proceed to the next question. So, gentlemen, yeah, just important people should be listening. I think they've chosen where they want, so, yeah. So let me start with a question for the panel, for everyone, just to answer as you see fit, because this is sort of an interdisciplinary sort of question or multidisciplinary sort of question. Have we learned anything these past 2 days, or are these just a bunch of nice stories, some of them quantitative, some qualitative, but, you know, ultimately stories that are true about a specific thing, but not general?
Now we vote.
Who would like to start?
Well, speaking as a member of this very high diversity panel,
that was a joke.
It's all me.
six older white males. You can see where wisdom is focused. I've been away for a reason. How to explain, but. I've actually been rather impressed by people being able to put together different disciplines in the work which they've been doing. I mean, my reflection is that this is partly influenced by Robert and Adam. That there's been rather a lot of work on rather small areas, as opposed to trying to put together bigger picture questions. So that's my concern, is how in a world where all the incentives academically focus on doing relatively narrow bits of work, beautifully crafted, how do you break out of that sort of environment and get students to do larger pieces of work which cover different disciplines and so on? Or is that just an impossible hope? Do you have to basically wait until you're our age?
Don't say it.
So, at our age, we're allowed to do what we want. So is that the purpose of having older white males around?
Sorry. Anyone else?
I must say I'm very happy to be here, because this, for me, has been a conversation between social scientists who share more than we think we share. Even there are differences in the approach, I think we share a common methodology, which is, you know, it's very much grounded in economics and quantitative methods. And there is also the long run picture. So I think this is very good news. And I think this is a new development to a large extent. And from that perspective, I'm living the experience. This is our third year in Madrid as a part of a department of social scientists, with political scientists, sociologists, and economists, and economic historians. So here I feel very much at home. So this is the good news. The bad news is that I think, you know, I think I told some of you in private conversations, building bridges with historians is a major challenge. In economic history, we learn a lot from engaging in conversation with economists. But I think political historians and historians in general don't read political science. And you're doing history without noticing. Or I don't know how aware you are that you're doing history, good political history. But there is a kind of segmented political history field, and you should build bridges. with the other side.
Yeah, I must admit, I'm not very sensitive to disciplinary distinctions. Most of the time, I don't know which discipline I am. But so here's what worries me. Perhaps here's how we might think. I'm thinking of the church on the tribunal, the paper of the Tribunales de Indios. Yes. So this is basically an attempt to control the principle, attempts to control the agent by activating the masses, yes, or threatening it with the masses. I'm thinking, well, that's what the Chinese are doing these days. Yes. It's a very interesting paper on repression in China, which shows that what the provincial leaders want most to avoid is any information about unrest within their province that would filter to the leadership. Moreover, what happens, the 180,000 public events, or small events, whatever they're called, events in China, which are meetings of 15 or more people. And it turns out that the way they're handled is, typically, the leaders are detained for a short period of time, and then demands are quietly conceded. But if things get out of hand and the top leadership finds out about it, then the top leadership punishes the provincial party secretary and concedes a demand. Yes, the central government is always on the right, on the side of the people. It's the old Russian tradition. The Russian had this Batyushka Pop. The Tsar was your father, yes? And it was, again, those intermediate bureaucrats who are oppressing the people. So we have kind of a whole world of examples like that. And somehow we have to, I think, develop systematic ways of thinking across contexts when we bump into these kind of historical instances. I'm not sure how to do it. In principle, if we really had strong theory, then that would discipline our analysis of different historical conditions. But somehow it's not working.
Got it? Anyone else? We can move on to
I'm surprised because I thought that Adam was going to say something else, so I was prepared. I thought you were going to explain to what you explained to me yesterday, which I thought it was very interesting, in terms of our methodologies of research, which is basically this idea. I mean, when you say, what did we learn, right? There is a methodological side and a theoretical or substantive side. And on the methodology, and I'm kind of basically here reporting back what you were telling me, right? We had a period where we had cases. And then we moved to this, bankrupt, I hope it's not completely bankrupt, enterprise of panels, let's put it more than cross-section of panels, right? And because everybody was interested in external validity and, divesting cases from their names and so on and so forth, and we had all this. And then somehow, I don't know if it's because it was not enough or because people, they're also fashion, so people get tired and move from, thing to thing, we went to quasi-experimentation in different forms, investing a lot on internal validity. And in the way this leads to all these things looking like cases again or anecdotes, if you want to be a bit, exaggerate a bit, but could be that just that. So the question is, there are different ways of defending this quest for, some of the internal validity or this type of new way of research, the problem with it is sometimes it looks like people are fishing for the identification. So you have students that are looking for, what is the border that I will find? What is the mountain that will, whatever, right? So that's a problem. So a possible solution, the typical solution is to say, look, You have a model and a theory. You are within a family of models or a family of theories, and I'm, you know, the guy that, like in a lab, is looking for this way of testing, and we hopefully will be many testing this in these different borders of the world, and at some point we'll know everything about the effect. That's one possibility. The other one is, and it, when you are old, it gets you anxious because you know that you're going to die and you will only see a few borders being studied and all of them, right? And young people have more time, and so they can do this. The other solution is to write long papers, not books, but, you know, long papers meaning you have your border, but it's not just the border. You know, I think that it would be nice to have papers that start from general, you know, you have your theory, you have general, like, descriptive statistics, and then you kind of zoom in into something, and you construct layers of evidence that make your argument plausible. But this then needs a journal, because journals want, you know, 10,000 words or less, at least in political science, and this may imply not 60,000 words, which it would be a book, but 20,000. So we need entrepreneurs that want to become editors. That's, you know, a possible way of moving forward to do that, to ask for these, you know, the basically constructing plausible arguments.
I want to take off from something that you and then Adam said. Adam worried in his remarks yesterday that with this, with papers written as they have been written here, we might end up with a pile of anecdotes, and in your word, John Paul, was stories. And so I want to begin by defending anecdotes. I have a confession to make. I have a PhD in anthropology, and anthropologists are social scientists who think that the plural of anecdote is evidence. So I am well disposed towards anecdotes and multiple anecdotes. However, having said that, I do want to flag a limitation of papers of the type that we have considered here, and I'm talking now of those which were on the more economic side rather than the political side, those which were about economic growth in one way or another, and I'm thinking of the excellent paper about engineers, the density of engineers as a predictor of, in different countries, as a predictor of subsequent economic growth. And that paper and others too are essentially comparative. That is, they compare the circumstances, the conditions of one country and against other countries, including their subsequent economic growth. And the problem with that whole approach, which is actually the dominant approach in the study of economic development, the problem with the approach is that it assumes that economic development is analogous to a marathon race, where the position of the runners, i.e. the countries, is just a function of their own internal condition. Like Germany is ahead of Latin America because Germany has many, many, many more engineers in 1900 than Latin America in 1900. And what that whole conception, which is, as I said, fundamental to the whole way that we think about economic development, what it ignores is the world system, the larger system in which all this is happening. And so I keep wondering how people writing papers of this kind might do a bit more to link up their particular cases, engineers, for example, to issues of the large trends in the world economy. Latin America's lagging position is not just because it had very few engineers. It's because of several basic forces on Latin America emanating from the core of the, or the center of the world economy. One of them is the fact that technological innovation was concentrated in the core, and therefore the development of the periphery depended heavily on the importing of capital goods from the core, leading to chronic balance of payments deficits in the core, in the periphery, number one. Number two, another fundamental force was deteriorating terms of trade between the periphery and the core. And number three, which we're seeing played out every day now, the pro-cyclical influences in the periphery emanating from core macroeconomics. Right now, we have been in this regime of extremely low interest rates, justified by the theory, the incorrect theory, that in order to boost aggregate demand, you have to have extremely low interest rates. And that is then leading to, then as the core countries begin to, quote, normalize interest rates, there's a wholesale disruption happening in the so-called emerging markets in the periphery, with capital flowing out and so on. This is what's happening right now. So the third big mechanism is pro-cyclical macroeconomics in the periphery as a result of the macroeconomics in the core. These three mechanisms are fundamental causes of the lagging of the periphery over the past two centuries. And the question then is, how can people doing these sort of comparative studies, such as engineer density, try and link up their arguments to these overarching big bulldozer forces affecting the world economy? And I leave that as a question mark.
Thank you.
So a second question, just to follow up on some of the questions of what we have learned, is really more directed to the historians in the panel, but if anybody wants to chime in as well, is that the historical record, many of the papers use the historical record, but it is taken really as reliable or given, and sometimes it even comes from secondary sources. So we have this question of, you know, whether we, for example, as political scientists, should be more critical of the historical sources we're using in our work, or how much should we be going into the original archives and doing the type of work historians do, and incorporate that into our work to be taken seriously. So, you know, this is kind of a general concern, you know, or is there space for, you know, collaboration? How should we think about our sources?
Okay, may I pick on that one? As a historian, let me say that historians have no problem with this. We know how to deal with sources. We know how to critically evaluate sources. We know how to control for biases in sources. That's our daily bread. And I think that's no problem if you can work with a historian or adopt the historical methods that we use. That's fine. Political scientists can, you can either use secondary materials that have been gathered by historians. Several papers cited some of my work on which they use. So, you know, and there's been debates about the reliability of that. But in any case, one can approach it in the same manner. There's no reason that political scientists accept time and effort. Generating data sets is not easy. Historians think that's a natural part of their life, and so they don't complain. Political scientists want to get to the theory, run the data, and go home. So that's one issue. The other issue, I was very impressed in the papers that when they do deal with historical data, they've read the historical literature in a lot of these cases, and people were aware of the larger questions. So there was a sense that you're more aware of historians than historians are aware of you. That's, I would also say. Recently, at least in the United States, the historical profession has become very strange and moved away from the social sciences and declared themselves a humanities, like a lot of anthropology has done in the United States. And so I find I'm a kind of fellow traveler of economists and economic historians. I'm a social historian myself. And I find it delightful to talk to people because I get ideas and interesting. You guys work with models all the time, so it's fun to see it. I hate running those regressions, but it's nice to see that, that there are interesting ideas and interesting debates, and you can then integrate them with other kinds of things. There was a talk here about the how land was distributed and the conditions, and we had a nice dissertation at Columbia on the Mapuche lands that were distributed in Chile, and they knew about the Homesteading Act in the United States. They talked about it, and then they sold them only in large plots for 90% in cash. So, I mean, there are ways of looking. There's nice comparative data to be found. And I just wish more historians would do what you do. But I don't think there's any problem about, we have all the tools to handle questions about the validity of materials. I mean, this is well done, and historians know how to do it. So I encourage some of you political scientists to work with a few historians, if you can find them. That's the only problem.
Can I turn the question around and ask whether to historians whether you can do history without theory? Because by definition, data is infinite. Right?
Right.
And at one point, we will be able to have super big data, and we will be able to crunch all this data in 1 second. But in the meantime, you have to choose. And, you know, you can only choose if you have plausible stories, almost causal, even if wrong. And, so I think, you know, it's the other way around. The problem is with history. Not with us.
Well, that's an interesting position. Most historians will tell you they don't have any theoretical model, but they all do.
They do.
Every one of them. Everyone lays out a particular position, makes an argument. There's accumulation of arguments. We tend to build on each other's works. We do define things chronologically. So that tends to look at origins and development, and rather than cross-cutting in our analysis. It's rare for someone to do a time specific and then look at pieces, and we always kind of instinctively look at historical evolution. But there's no question that the basic theoretical models are there, but we never make them explicit. They're all implicit. So I don't think there's any problem. I mean, you get nice books out of historians and you read them, I assume, once in a while.
They look nice. May I second Carlos's point in a slightly different way? I really want to emphasize the importance of thinking about mechanisms. Evolutionary biologists these days say that something can be said to be heritable if you have lots of statistical evidence, but also the chemical mechanism. If you just have a lot of correlations and no chemical mechanism, not enough. And I really think we should sort of have the same norm. We cannot test the mechanisms because we don't have the chemical basis for validation, but we just have to specify the mechanisms by which all these effects occur. And particularly, I must admit that Jenny's no longer here. She was my student, and I fought with her for years on this. These effects at a distance, these effects 200 years later. I mean, unless we really understand the mechanism by which things are perpetuated, it just remains a mystery. And then, since one can always doubt econometrics, yes? I mean, one axiom of econometrics is that there is no estimation that's not biased, right? We end up not knowing very much. So this I want to emphasize, is mechanisms explicitly specified.
Jan?
Yes, I would like to, you know, I couldn't agree more. Social science historians and economic historians are part of that, are in no man's land in the sense that we are not proper historians for historians. So, you know, I side with social scientists, or I agree with Carlos on this more than with historians. But I think the credibility of social scientists for historians is explaining persistence over time. Mm-hmm. I think we have a problem here, which is the bad history of good econometrics, which is you solve a problem, an identification problem, which is looking for an exogenous variable in the past, but simultaneously you compress history, as Gareth Austin says. And that means that you don't explain why on earth everything is determined by an event in the past. So you have different degrees of globalization and deglobalization. You have technological change at different speed. You have political changes, and nothing of that appears to matter. So I think even though Acemoglu and Robinson wrote a paper a few years ago trying to explain persistence, and they put a very oversimplistic story, in my view, was there is a coexistence between changes in political institutions that are where the jure power, political power exists, but simultaneously economic institutions persist, and this is where de facto power remains. But this is, I think, is not very convincing to me. So I think the challenge is, if we, from social sciences, we want to convey a message to historians, you have to tell them how shocks or events in the past persist over time.
Got a question back here.
So can I ask a question? I've noticed there are a lot of political scientists motivated to try to understand divergent development outcomes. We're here to understand long-run development in Latin America. But there are historians who will say that we can't even acknowledge that those differential development outcomes exist. In the sense that a lot of historians will say, as a starting point, there is no great divergence. Or that even talking about the great divergence implies forms of bias that make it a question that's not even, we're not even supposed to ask. So I'm wondering, is this something that there's a good response, or there's a way to handle this that will be consistent with the way historians think about the world? Or is this just sort of a fundamental difference in the way political scientists view outcomes relative to other places?
Can I just clarify? Are you saying that a significant number of historians deny that there has been the great divergence, that is, in terms of income, but in terms of material living conditions, in terms of well-being across the last two centuries?
I don't know that they would deny that it exists, but they would consider it a question that is not, you're not permitted to ask an answer for reasons related to history as a discipline.
No, I don't think, no.
You don't think so?
Well, the divergence argument grew out of a bunch of historians debating the issue, and no, historians tend to be very centered on the uniqueness of their events and the explanation being chronological in a given society, in a given time, in a given place. On the other hand, more and more they're opening up, some of them are opening up to debates relative to comparative change over time on other societies. And very quickly, once you examine one society and see the same patterns in institutions, you can begin to...
You think they're becoming more open or less open to that?
Some are less open and some are more open, I think is a divide. But if you really... Some of these technical medieval Islam, for example, maybe a highly technical field where people yet got all their instruments of research and haven't gone to the next intellectual level. There really are some fields like that. The classics has gone way beyond. They got all their tools, they know archaeology, and then they begin to talk about general themes and compare classical Rome to modern societies and debates and issues. And the Roman historians have been very open, the medieval historians as well. But there are some fields, if you work on medieval Chinese, I'm sure it takes you so long to get the tools that everything is unique and therefore they won't engage.
There is a little bit of a tendency in the study of the history of conquest that if you really say China or Middle East was backward, and that was considered not very politically correct. I think there is an element. I don't think it's completely true. I think there's an element that everything is relative among some segment of the history profession.
Right. I think that's maybe what she's getting at.
Okay. which I can sympathize.
Can I ask a question of you, sitting in front? Why is causality so important? Why is everybody after causal identification?
To me?
Everybody. Everybody who's after that, yes? Why? I mean, I understand you cannot publish without it. And that is a sufficient reason. Do you have other reasons?
If policy matters to you at all, you need to know causal effects as opposed to correlations, right? That's the most important thing for me as an economist. I want to be able to cause change, and so I need to see what has caused change previously and sort of expect that there's enough external validity that I can do it again. There's a lot of infamous examples of correlations that look causal but aren't, and so you try to affect change again, and it doesn't happen, and it presumably is because you didn't you weren't careful about it being a causal relationship or not. That's what I would say, but there's plenty more people who could.
Policy that you can adopt that would be effective depends on circumstances, yes? Depends on conditions. Not all conditions. You can't just take a policy out of your box and throw it in there.
Absolutely, which is why you really need to care about mechanisms, right? And knowing all those mechanisms, it's what helps you think about the external validity of your causal effects, right? But that's...
I think that it's not a given at all.
Not what?
It's not a given at all that it is important and it should be. I mean, clearly we're trying to do like causal work, but I think that it's a huge question and there's like huge philosophical debates about it as well. So I think if you take like Hume and Kant, they would say like it is extremely important, like that there is causality in, at least in philosophy. And if you take Bentham, he says like it's completely irrelevant. So I think that it is not a question for economics, but it's a question for like sciences or human knowledge in general. I think that one key thing for us as, I don't know, economic historians or economists trying to use history is that time, in a sense, like does give you one of the few arrows in the world that there is, which is like from the past to the present. And then, I mean, unless you believe in some weird physics, like that is one of the things that we are trying to like use to identify things. But I think that more than causality is like trying to quantify some of these phenomena. And I think that that might be where sometimes we have some differences with historians, where it's trying to, I mean, not marry with one hypothesis, but clearly we're doing some like violence to the history and say this thing matters 80%. And yes, there could be 10 stories, but like it turns out that we try to quantify one of them and say this one was 10% or this one was 80%. And I think that at the end of the day, probably we do that thinking that if at least we understand or we are aware of these historical forces, then we might change them or we might have like some policy, not prescriptions, but at least that policymakers know. And I think that that's another usual question, which is like, okay, like why do we care about history? And you give us this story about whatever, engineers or missions, or I mean, there've been like a ton of papers here, and it's not clear like what the policy prescription should be. But at least the information is out there for policymakers to say, okay, there are geographic forces, there are institutional forces, there are educational forces, whatever, and maybe there are also historical forces that like you should be aware. But I think, personally speaking, is a way to understand the world, and I don't think that there's like any value for it to be causal or not causal. I think it's a bit of a fashion as well.
Can I disagree with that? I think the opposite of causality is darkness. Things don't cause outcomes, and outcomes just happen because God willed them or because the poor are guilty. And I think that's worse. I'd rather have causality.
The opposite of causality is maybe everything is in order.
That's just another form of darkness, no? Everything
no,
is.
Not.
If everything
it's
causes
not.
Everything,
it's
then.
Not. Maybe we have the wrong method. But maybe, you know, the Acemoglu Banerjee program is just the wrong program. Maybe we should think about endogeneity. We can study historical sequences of things without saying that one thing always causes something else.
But it's perfectly possible. I mean, it's evident that pretty much everything is endogenous. But right. It's also perfectly possible to talk about causality within a world in which
everything is endogenous. We can figure things out, how things co-occur, yes.
Just simultaneous equations.
But that's maybe not the methodological paradigm that I think has been imposed on us.
Well, I agree with that, and I think that's a huge problem. But that's really saying we need to have models where we take into account, we understand that all sorts of things are going on causing other things, and we find that very difficult to do because imagine what a graduate student would face when he or she is told that they can't write a neat little article about whatever it is.
It's worse with assistant professors coming out for tenure, if I may. First of all, I think that we have a priori conception of the world, and we think that even if it's a complex structure of causality, we think that there are causes leading to consequences. And it may be that we are, the children of whatever, enlightenment or something. And the second part is this. I mean, Adam and I have been in the same, at different moments in time, in the same department. And when you put aside some kind of system where you think about, again, causality and testing of hypotheses and so on in a relatively scientific way, then the basis for rational deliberation disappear. And so then it's all about power struggles. It's I like this paper because I like it, not because it fits into a certain research, not program, but set of methods to determine how good that is, right? And I had colleagues like this, and so those that got us to are going to get tenure. I think that they are. I mean, it's a very instrumental argument. I know.
I understand all the institutional constraints. I mean, obviously, and I'm not saying that that's not what people who want to publish their articles should do. But okay, so comes Acemoglu, 2000, yes, and says, all right, so these Europeans came to these places, and some places were mosquitoes, and some places there were no mosquitoes. When there were no mosquitoes, they settled, established good institutions. In the other ones, they just extracted what they could. And then these institutions produced development, as a matter of fact, to the point that the less developed places became more developed and whatnot. Now we need to causal identification. Yes, so we got an instrument for institutions. They are the pilgrims or the settlers. As somebody remarked today, we're no longer clear whether settlers are really an instrument or whether they are the cause, but okay. And André Schleifer says, no, they are not an instrument, they are the cause, because they bring not only institutions but also the human capital, so we have this whole discussion about it. But basically we have this notion, okay, so these institutions cause development and we have to worry about causality, so we have to find an instrument. If you look at Acemoglu's original distribution of institutions for the first time that we have any kind of classification of them, and then look at their distribution by the time they start looking at growth, the correlation is 0.018. These institutions have changed in the process. One, it means it's a bad instrument, it's a weak instrument. But that's not my point. My point is, but the institutions are endogenous. They change in the course of history for all kinds of reasons. And I think we're too obsessed with institutions. I'm sorry, with causality.
We have a question. Do you want to say something? You see, you'll wait first about this particular point.
Thanks. Now, I just want to go back to what Leandro was saying a minute ago, talking about what we need to do is discuss persistence and to show persistence. And I wonder if we should change that. What we need to do is not show persistence, but we need to show variation in persistence. I mean, we really need to be honest about this, about the publication bias, right? The issue that once, this is not criticism of any paper in particular, but the idea that once you show persistence from something that happened 500 years ago to today, that's going to lead to a publication in a top journal. If you say there's no persistence across time, you're never going to get that published, right? I mean, this is the whole point. We talk about Emilio's paper, which is great, but, you know, citing the Besley and Reynald Quayle paper, which I find completely implausible, the idea that there's, you know, conflict 500 years ago in Africa predicts conflict today, they show that and they got it published in the APSR. And if they showed that there's no correlation, there's no way they would have gotten it published in the APSR. We got to the point where, again, these are really good papers the last 2 days, but I start seeing things from economics which sound more and more implausible, to the point where, was it a couple of years ago in the Quarterly Journal of Economics, there is that article about anti-Semitic pogroms in 1300 predict voting for Nazis in 1930, right? More recently, I've heard about, you know, Ola Olson's paper about the Roman roads. Probably some of you read that. The Roman roads 2,000 years ago predicts outcomes today in Europe. I mean, I'm just waiting for the time when we talk about cave paintings predicting sort of, you know, things more recently. I mean, it's just going to an extreme where I wonder we're getting overwhelmed by all this persistence. What we need to have is more publications that are showing no persistence. Where, again, the editors need to be publishing that kind of thing. It kind of reminds me, again, the trend against the RCTs. It used to be the RCTs were always showing statistically significant evidence. And now it's really nice to see sometimes where we say, yeah, we did this RCT and we got no results whatsoever. And they get published. Not in the top journals, but like World Development will publish some of those, you know? And it's good to see that. I'd love to see more papers that say, yeah, we tested for persistence and we found none. And here's our paper and we should get it published. You know, I'd like to see more of that. And I wonder if the panel had anything to say about that.
We really have to start a journal then. Long articles that show no persistence.
Shall we get Agustinas and Pavios and then get back to the panel?
I guess my comment was about Adam's question, like, should we care about causality? And obviously, I'm in the group of people who are not going to get tenure because I'm still doing country-level difference in differences, right? But with that caveat, so that means you should probably not even care, anyone, what I have to say. I kind of think that the use of history to inform political science theory is missing in a lot of ways, that history is being used a lot of times to identify natural experiments, but that we're not often delving enough into the actual historical political process that led to the emergence of certain institutions, and that we're simplifying a lot what those institutions looked like in ways that lead to very simplistic theories, and that the process usually of, once we do look into the process of institutional formation, it was a messy process, it was complex, there was negotiation, it wasn't like institutions would clearly lead to one outcome as many of our theories predict, but oftentimes there's variation actually in what institutions look like that can be exploited because it would lead to different expectations, and so on. So I kind of think that I share some of your concern, but I still think I agree with Felipe that it is helpful to know what cost what. I do think it's part of what I think of what constitutes knowledge. At the same time, as a second point, I also think that causality isn't the only thing we should care about. So in that sense, I disagree with you, Jean-Paul, that lack of causality is darkness. Because I think that the other thing that looking at history enables us to do is to put things in perspective and to identify patterns that deserve to be explained. And that's a descriptive process. It's not about causality at all. It's understanding why is it that Mexico looks this way today when it looked so different 150 years ago or in a specific domain? Or why is it that Latin America today is so unequal when in 1500 it wasn't that unequal compared to the rest of the world? But these are things that are just descriptive questions that come up as really important questions out of descriptive work. So it's just my... Yeah, of course, but there's research that comes before the causality work that establishes what's the important research agenda we should pursue.
but it's an agenda because we want to establish causal relations to explain.
Yeah. But I do think that a lot of the work that's being done in political science using history, because it's being simply used as identifying a natural experiment. And I'm not saying like the papers presented here, I'm just thinking in general things that are being published, that because it's coming from a point of trying to identify natural experiments, then it's like, okay, what's the relevance of this? Is this actually a relevant question? Is the effect that you're identifying relevant in historical perspective? I don't think, Felipe, we're actually doing the saying this explains 20 or 80%. We're identifying simply the point estimate, and we're not comparing the magnitude of that with other causes in general. So, anyway.
I have a question for the panel. I mean, I have heard that it's really bad to try to have a theory or a statistical approach that try to explain the whole world, you know, like many countries. So that's because there are many things happening around the world, and that's really bad. And the other thing I just heard is that it's really bad as well to try to explain something in the very long run, like 200 years, 1,000 years, or even 8,000 years, as some people have done. So my question is that, okay, it's really difficult to have a causal relationship between something that happened 1,000 years ago till today, 500 years ago until today, or it's very difficult to have a hypothesis that's trying to explain many countries. But the question for you, so what is the optimum size of where we want to explain a country, a group of countries? What is the optimal length of time that in which we is viable to find causalities? 10 years, 50 years? I mean, because what we do here is to try to explain, like, what some people have done is there's a bit the whole world, many countries. I agree with what Professor Wade was saying, that okay, if we want to explain the great divergence that is played by the forces of globalization that occur in the 18th century, and to have a model for that is really difficult. It's almost impossible. So I think it's better a description of what happened than try to find a variable that explains the divergence. But my question, okay, what is the optimum size of what we want to explain, and what is the optimum length of time in which it's possible to talk about causality?
I don't think it's a question of length of time. It's a question of mechanism. So when Banerjee and I, you remember, studied the effects of different ways of extracting taxes in India, and find that when they were extracted by landlords, there was more inequality, and that eventually had an effect on productivity 100 years later, 150 years later. But then they worry about the mechanism, and they say, well, more inequality produced more conflict, and that perpetuated inequality and whatnot. And they look for incidences of actually conflict every few years in those districts which were more unequal. So whether it's accurate historically or not, I don't know. But you know, they had a mechanism, and they had some evidence that mechanism in fact operated for 150 years. If you can do it, fine. If you can do it for 8,000 years, I'd be convinced at least.
But there was just one country.
Yeah, I agree.
But I don't think, at least in my position, is that it's not that you cannot use or you should not use panels with countries. It's just that there are trade-offs you know, in terms of what you can use, you know, what, where are you going when you are using one kind of method versus the other, right? And so perhaps a combination of both is maybe better, although it is has a big time, you know, you have time constraints and all kinds of constraints, right? I think that the mechanisms is also about, you know, it's about all these, the shortening, the how long and how short the time has to be between A and B. But it, there is something that is, to me, very irritating about, not the papers here at all, you know, I enjoy them very much, all of them. But, you know, this use of concepts that are so, you know, it's like they are chewing gum. So the institutions word. You know, institutions are used in all senses. Sometimes they're about expropriatory elites. Sometimes they are about courts. And then many researchers use them as they please. They find this, and then they say, this is an institution. And then they go, and they say, this is an institution. And a table is an institution, and Adam is an institution. Everything is an institution.
This is absolutely right.
So, you know, there must be a way out of this, right? Which is perhaps a bit of humility about the use of these concepts and the precision about these, they, you know, these words that are used. And of course, there is a tendency to say, you know, this is an institution and we are all, which is not my case, but, you know, all institutionalists. So we are a big family of brothers and sisters. And this is, I think it's important. The mechanism and the concept also, yet the starting with the right way to think about how to define and then measure and so on and so forth. And it's difficult.
And we should distinguish between institutions and organizations.
Can I follow up on something Agustina started introducing, which is a little bit the question of how we choose the questions that we want to talk about, I mean, or study. So when Jean-Paul put together the program with and when we put the program for last year in Stanford, we really were very opportunistic. I mean, we just took the papers that we found interesting, fascinating, and we took them. But then students are very opportunistic. You know, they take a dissertation topic because they found an instrument that looks really cool. And the question is a little bit, you know, would we have organized the conference very differently if it was on the substantive problems that are really pressing and that we should be studying? I mean, would we have organized a conference or written our papers without identification, but on, I don't know, we had this list, social mobility, or the stability of party systems, or questions of public health that you introduced actually in your, which might be more important than many of the things we're studying. I mean, that's thrown to the panel as a challenge.
But also tied together.
Yeah.
I mean, you're saying we need to have a, we want to work in a coherent way together. We need to have a big common problem which we're working on, which seems to be a basic thing about interdisciplinarity, actually, that it's only when you have a problem, when different people are confronted with a very similar problem, but which requires different disciplines, then it seems to me people try and break down disciplinary barriers.
I mean, is there like a big lacuna or something we really should have been talking about?
Yes.
Yes, the world system.
Varieties of capitalism.
No, but I mean, innovation and all these big questions of the moment, innovation, segregation, populism, we've, as it were, let those things float, and education, actually, and how that ties into that linkage. So I'm very sympathetic to this idea, yes.
You know, I want to be a bit more positive about the, you know, in the, sense, in the following sense, that, you know, the papers are not, you know, it looks almost as if we were saying the papers are anecdotes, and I don't think it is true. You know, they fit into important topics, and so basically I was listing the topics, and, you know, we have talked about development growth, where there is, the papers I saw have this sort of semi-anti-institutionalist flavor to them, right? It's human capital, and so all these kinds of things. So, you know, I like them. Then there are papers on political order, so on the construction of order, so Luz Marina's, struggle to understand coordination dynamics, papers about the behavior of stationary bandits or dictators, papers about the effects of a stationary band or, you know, the effects of repression. Then there are papers about rebellion and a few papers I would have liked to see more on identity, which in a way are related to political order. So all these papers fit into, you know, clear research agendas, and it's not, you know, and so I think it's, you know, clearly that, you know, they are fit very important into very important problems. Then there are things that perhaps we haven't seen, and political institutions for one, which is fine, you know. One that I think is really important is elites. We talked about these networks, thinking about, how the state is controlled by elites, persistence of elites, the thing that, you know, now a lot of, well, not a lot of people, but you have this literature in the U.S. about the rich or the elites controlling the state or whatever, or influencing policy. But I would like to see this for Latin America, for the elites in sub-Saharan Africa, and so on and so forth, more on preferences and identity. I think the papers on identity were really interesting, and I would like to see more. And then welfare consequences of all these things. So, I mean, the things that you list in the question. So, but you always, I mean, if you look for things and there is no one to present a paper, you will not be able to spend any money, right? And then you will not get any funding in the next iteration. So that cannot.
Can I just follow what Carlos was saying when, as you were ending on identity and preferences and these questions? The one big disciplinary area which we just don't touch on is psychology. And I was very struck by Adam's comment about the role of the great father, czar figure who gets, and your discussion about China. So I guess my question to Adam would be, what role do you see a sort of more psychological literature? I mean, including, I feel slightly naughty saying this, Foucault, including Foucault in how one understands these complex problems of getting groups of people to behave in ways, and your frogs jumping up earlier.
You've chosen the wrong victim for this one, because I've learned nothing from psychology. Ever.
Yeah, no, that was exactly what. Yes. I was just ever, what I wanted
ever,
to.
Ever. Okay.
What I wanted to know.
I don't see any role for it because I was trying recently to learn something from psychology. Oh. So I was trying to understand something about xenophobia and racism and whatnot.
Yes.
And all I found is that they just relabel things and say think that new labels constitute causes. I learned nothing from it, okay? I was trying to understand. If you look at economic determinants, you find, as always, that they always matter very little. So a lot is left. I can tell you in the best study, I think, which is Stanig and who's the co-author? Italian study, where they studied the regions in
Piero Stanig, the trade one, the European.
The regions, regions.
The China chart.
China. The China.
1%. Right?
Pardon?
The effect is 1%.
The effect is 0.7%.
Yes. Sorry, the effect of what?
Okay, so. They studied the effect of deindustrialization, and specifically China and European regions of Europe, on voting for right wing. Okay, and they find that the difference between district in the 75th percentile of losing job and 25th percentile of losing job is 0.7%. That means, you know, for a German AfD, that's from, which is 12.6, you know, add and subtract 3.5.
But that may just be that the logic is wrong rather than the economics unimportant.
If you read all these studies, you will find that the present economic situation matters, the fear, economic fears matter, economic context matter, but everything is always significant because everything is always significant. Yes, it gets 2 stars. But it doesn't matter. Most of it is somehow left to people who say, it's a, what? What's that? Selfish versus sociotropic cultural reaction. And what is that? Rather than a label for racism? So anyway, so I'm anti. You'll not get psychology from me. I think that's our story, if I may.
Yeah.
I think that's our story has to be thought in a, well, structural framework. It's a strategy. It was always a strategy, yes. The Tsar always publicly separated himself from the bureaucrats, the chinovniki, yes. And in fact, from time to time, when there were peasant rebellions, he punished the bureaucrats.
Yes.
And therefore, the people believed that, you know, it's just that these people escape from the control of the Tsar, and this is why they oppress us, rather than this good father, okay? If I may. No, I will not.
Yeah, please.
No, please.
So, Mussolini said something which haunts me until, I mean, for a long time.
Tell us.
He says at one time, in 1943, after he's captured for the first time, he's interviewed by Favesi, an Italian journalist, and he says at one time, I was not even a dictator. My will to command corresponded to the will to obey of the Italian people. There's something real to that.
I think
there's something real to that. Mr. Putin, Mr. Xi, their rule is not, well, they're authentically popular. With all the confines of propaganda, censorship, or whatnot, they are authentically popular. Their will to command corresponds to the will of the Chinese people to obey.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's a, well, psychological. One can understand it in Bayesian terms, I think. One can write Bayesian stories in which something like that would be true. So one doesn't need psychology for that. That's basically what I'm saying.
Shall we take a
couple
of people?
Shut up.
Well, it was a long time ago when I asked for the microphone, but let me link to the psychology, your statement on psychology. And as a general comment, I would like to remind of somebody from this place, Popper, and his opinion about psychology. And I have two references to make about that. I mean, if the preoccupation is to understand or explain persistence, history is not the place to go. History explains change, not persistence. That's what social sciences are good for. So that's something that needs to be somehow divided. The other thing which, if I can call myself a historian, I find, and as Carles said, not in this sort of set of papers, but on the general predicament of papers which are built in this methodology, is that the lack of disposition to test against the hypothesis. So systematically, the results are as predicted. And as our good colleague, Karl Popper, said many years ago, I mean, he left the school and the world about the time I came to LSE to study, without falsification, we are not going to go very far. And I'm missing that in the research. And for all the bad reputation that history has, a very badly specified regression is as anecdotical as a contingent epiphenomenon of some bad character, as your example for Mussolini. So I think that there are many bridges to build, but prior to that, the disposition to falsify and to go against the grain, that's why psychology or meteorology were not considered science by that fellow. And I wonder and I worry that this methodology, and particularly for those that they want to find the political, the policy implications, is becoming a little bit like that. Another, you know, tautology of sorts. For the disposition of regressions and work, people working in Latin America, I'd like to you to consider this very harsh article by Danny Roderick about how good, to papers of 2012, about how good and how effective these regressions are done to regress economic growth. So I'll be cautious in deriving implications because the effects that we always capture quite exposed could be lethal for people that they're on the ground. So I think our falsification is a more modest way to go, a more prudent, perhaps, and as so far has been the way that knowledge has improved, increased, and is always provisional.
Hi, thank you. This was also a long time ago, so it's about Adam's sentences about why people are just like finding an instrument and writing a thesis. I personally don't think that it's at all like that. I know a lot of people that are just writing things about what they want to know. That's my personal experience too with my three papers in my dissertation, and I think it's very bad to put everyone in the same category in that sense. I think we just need to do it and just write about whatever we think is important and just do it and not fall into the trap of finding an instrument. But I don't think, I mean, we can do that, but I think the real power is on tenured professors and editors that need to just accept the papers and evaluate professors in terms of the quality of their research and not their publications. So it's all supply and demand here. It's we can do it, but it's also up to other people to actually accept that. So I think it's a coordination game in that sense that we need to get out of this trap in which we are, but it needs coordination from everyone, not assistant professors. It's assistant professors, associate professors, tenured professors, everyone. And that's it, yeah.
Last thing I will say, I promise, one line. I just got an article turned down for a bad ID, bad causal ID. So, you know, it works this way. And it was by somebody your age.
Okay, so shall we move on to the next question?
I just want to ask a question.
A different way to study things, a paradigm that's different. And there's a group of people doing this thing called agent-based modeling, which thinks the world is very complicated and they have all these equations and everything is computational. So I just wanted to know what people thought about that and if that's an alternative that anybody sees. I don't use it, but I know that it's out there and I wanted to know if that would be an alternative then if everything is endogenous.
Let me answer this question. So I have a paper on this, an estate formation, published in an obscure book that I wrote with two computer scientists. One of them was a neighbor in Chicago, and we got, you know, talking about this. And I think it's a wonderful, you know, thing. And I think that, you know, I think that investment on this would be great. It's very difficult because you have to think very carefully about the parameters, and it's also difficult to get you know, to the right, you know, kind of a stationary structure, right? So, and then, you know, I presented this in the department in Princeton, and some of my colleagues didn't like it, so I just kind of decided to bury it and forget about it. But there must be, you know, I think there is a place. The problem with, this was Bob Cohen, right? And his point was very well taken. It was that it is very difficult once you do this to assess the validity of this against all the, you know, all the counterfactuals. You know, where are the, you know, where is the place that where you can compare with what has happened? And this kind of made me think that I couldn't do this. So, but as a research agenda, why not? Why not?
So we were talking about institutions and the sort of infinite morphability of institutions. Let's focus on one particular institution, which is itself flexible, but maybe slightly less broad. Democracy. Is democracy instrumental for any aspect of development, or is it merely constitutive? So, you know, you take the same view that democracy is itself a good, that it itself is a higher state of development than the lack of democracy for the reasons that we all know about. Is it additionally, there seems to be a big wave of studies that want to show that democracy instrumentally gets you other things that are good. Do you think, does the panel think that's true, or should we abandon these attempts and just state it is a good and we should have it for its own sake?
I talk too much.
But you've worked directly on that question, so I think it's directed at you.
So I think that, so in 2000, yes, I published a book on the topic, and I published a book on the topic because there were arguments saying dictatorships are better because only the dictatorships can mobilize investment in poor countries. And then there were arguments saying, no, democracy is better because democracy guarantees property rights and therefore promotes investment. And in fact, I published a paper with Fernando Limoggi in 1993 in which we showed that no paper published before 1982 showed in favor of democracy, and no paper published after 1982 showed in favor of dictatorship. So there was a little bit of ideology in these econometrics because, you know, the Reagan Revolution came in. So then I got annoyed, and with a group of students, we thought we're going to write the final word on the relationship to democracy and development. And we did it by every hook and track. We have very careful selection mechanisms in every place and whatnot, state of the art. Well, since then, there have been probably about 700 articles on that topic, and the results are all over the place. And I have a little note if you want. There are six reasons why they would be. Definitions of regimes, you know, classifications of regimes, data. It turns out that source of data really matters because they have different scope, regional scope. Some include Communist Party countries in the early period, some don't and whatnot. There's a big issue on whether the dependent variable is growth of total output or per capita output, because one of the things that we discovered in the 2000 book is that democracy does have an impact, but it's via demography. Namely, in democratic countries, people have fewer kids. Whether you control for selection, as you must, it turns out from a secondary analysis done a few years ago that 90% of 470 estimates do not control for selection. Take regimes as exogenous, which is, you know, patently biased. Okay. And finally, the estimators. The selection variable is, however you classify regimes, going to be a limited variable. Yes, whether it's zero, dichotomous or in some 0 to 1 scale, 1 or 0 to 100 scale. And then you're going to have this output equation, which may or may not be, the growth equation may or may not be linear. Panel series, You get bias from selection, you get bias from your performance, and the results are all over the place. Don't believe the last piece by Acemoglu, Nardu, and whatnot. It's perfectly well done, it's state of the art, but there are many other states of the art, and there is an article, Watchark and somebody else, who uses the same specification, the same data, different estimator, get a different result. So my view on this topic now is many years of life wasted.
Robert, you guys, do you have anything? No. It's a mess, right? It's landmine, so I leave it to the...
You did have the final word, Adam.
Do the historians have anything to say about these sorts of questions? Do you sort of watch from the sidelines and laugh at us doing these sorts of things? Yeah.
Well, you're biasing it by to begin with. I mean, why assume the democracy and then look to prove it and then... I mean, we get all these studies that, you know, the English model of industrial development. And then it turns out we're living in a world where there are, you know, the Chinese model of development. 100 years from now, they'll think England was a very strange little place that went deviant with its strange little aristocracy, land tenure position, and it doesn't look like normal. Whereas China is the way you develop. So, in other words, there's all kinds of biases written into the questions of research, and it'd be nice. Historians tend not to do that too much, so since they don't model that much, they also take they look at multiple causal factors and try to make some coherence. They do put an argument together and everything else, but I mean, this business about there must be a well-defined, well-developed model of development that we can all just apply everywhere. And it becomes very complicated and very much a question of personal biases as they set the question.
Okay, so another question is, do we have really a political economy of Latin America? I mean, one of the striking things in these conferences is we had all these Latin Americans presenting papers on slavery in the U.S., Africa, you know. So is there anything distinct? I mean, is that enterprise just... you know, not really important to put the proper name of Latin America, and this is just about political economy of development, broadly speaking? Or is there a merit in putting actually the Latin America in there? Is there something distinct?
But, you know, Latin America, the range, the variation is enormous, right? So you go from Haiti to Chile, and so it almost kind of, what, covers two-thirds of all the variants, or like three-fourths of all the variants in developmental. So why should we talk about Latin America something? Right, just because the Portuguese and the Spanish govern it?
Well.
I don't think there is anything like that, but.
Well, I thought that was an argument for yes, but it turned into an argument for no.
So I think that, exactly, so it's precisely that, right, that I think that a Latin American can exploit that variation to talk to almost everyone, but to turn Latin America in a sort of a, you know, coterie of Latin Americanists and think that because it's Latin America, there is something special, which in a way there is, right? Because there is this common trajectory in the past. I think that would be wrong. So I would favor the, you know, thinking about Latin America as this place that offers you so much in terms of variation. No, thank you.
I'm going to return the challenges to Leandro. One of the issues about if it's worth continuing research on Latin America or the variety within, there is an additional issue that is the comparability, and is this sort of pedestrian comparison with the United States. I know that Leandro has his views on that, so to you. But Adam mentioned the
the graph that is the main evidence in colonial origins of comparative development. And I use this in, I didn't occur to me, a colleague showed it to me, but I use it in my classes, and it's very effective. I invite you to run with Ashemolu Johnson and Robinson data the regression with the data in Latin America, and I discussed this with a couple of you, and check the effect and how tenable this theory is, on which nobody has ever dared to suspect. So I would invite you to greater skepticism on your tenets, on your models, because if you look at that big interpretation, super effective and productive for the attention or the revival of the attention on economic history and long-term causes and effects has been fantastic. The problem with the following is this lack of skepticism has probably been forgotten that, in fact, in that argument, the Latin American case doesn't hold the water, or that argument for Latin American case doesn't hold the water. But it has been very helpful and very useful for the comparison with the United States, which poses the whole model with a problem. Now, you tell us, Leandro, what you think of the comparability with the United States.
I'm old and tired, so I'm not going to talk much about that. But I think my answer to Alberto's question is, you're right in the sense what Latin America is a good place to start comparing to other parts of the world, because you have this large variance, but also because probably you would find better comparators than the US. I mean, the US is a technological frontier, is the leader, so there is a temptation to compare to the US. In European history, before 1980, I would say before, at least in economic history, before Patrick O'Brien's book on economic growth in Britain and France, the conventional wisdom was that you would look at the case of Britain and use it as a template to decide whether other countries were doing well or not. So Landi's book, for instance, and so many others, even in Spain, Jordi Nadal's excellent book. You know, in every country you had this template, and whether the template applied or not would give you an idea of how successful the way to development was. So I think this disappeared 30 years ago in European economic history, and I guess it's still the case in Latin America. You use the US as comparators, but from a social science point of view, if you think geography is different, institutions are different, factor endowments are different, relative prices are different. So how on earth should we, and obviously they would have different steady states if you believe in that. So what's the point of practicing a sort of masochistic, self-defeating strategy in your research? So when I wrote on this about almost 20 years ago, for the first time, there were some cries. A friend of Agustin and mine, Roberto Cortes Conde, was saying, how are we going to compare ourselves to sub-Saharan Africa if we are the children of the Enlightenment and the French Revolution? But in fact, even levels of income in Latin America and in sub-Saharan Africa at the time of independence, with 140 years difference, were similar. So it's not only geography, latitude, climate. There were so many features in common, and they had also the colonial legacy. From a comparative perspective, I think it would make much more sense to compare India to Peru or Brazil or Jamaica to Cuba than to compare everything to the 13 colonies of North America. So that's my point. And from that point of view, I think opening Latin America to the rest of the world, as Carlos was suggesting, it would be a kind of antidote against the systematic comparison to the US.
Okay. I think this, for me, this discussion about templates when you're comparing apples and pears or apples and oranges.
Can you use the microphone?
Or pears and lemons. Takes me back to one of the many points I learned from Anna Maria's paper yesterday, and this is we need to look more carefully at, if you like, quality diversity amongst institutions. I mean, your discussion about rebelocracy, I thought, did stimulate an awful lot of debate. Rebelocracy was interesting, and it's because it seemed to be good for growth, because it was better than what it displaced. Yeah, rebelocracy wasn't an optimal institutional arrangement; it was simply better than the one that was already in place. And I think this brings me back to a larger, and to some extent, it's an older debate. You know, sometimes second-best institutions are okay. You know. Second-best institutions won't necessarily take you all the way, but they might be a stepping stone to something better. Yeah, yeah. We only have to, you know, open any report by the IMF or, you know, go back to early Acemoglu to know what are the perfect institutions. You know, we know exactly what the best institutions are, always with inverted commas. So why don't we look at second-best templates? Why don't we look at second-best institutions and see where that takes us? Because, you know, much of the performance of Latin America for a certain period was described as, in pretty positive terms, they weren't first-best institutions. On the contrary, they were second-best institutions, which in some places, some periods, looked as if they might lead to, inverted commas, first-best institutions. But didn't necessarily do so, yeah? And again, if I can just press the point a little bit further, if we are looking at development in the long term, then I think we need to unbundle our institutions and see what particular institution, what particular combinations of public goods might serve very well at a particular place in a particular time to trigger growth and perhaps then development, accepting that in a different place, in a different period, in the same place, a rather distinct bundle of institutions might be required to move, you know, one ratchet up, one step up from, if you want to make the distinction, growth to development. So I do think we need to look at, inverted commas, institutional quality and appropriateness for time and place. And that means template diversity, I think.
We have one last question to pose to the panel. In a way, it's sort of a Colin's comment on steroids.
There's a tendency that some of us have been discussing at the coffee breaks over the last few decades to come up with theories that don't intentionally do this, but they end up sort of indirectly eliding lots of good things. So good things go together, right? So open institutions, less inequality, more participation, more democracy, more investment in public goods, more growth that leads to better investment and better and so on and so forth. So the problem when I teach this to my master's students is that I have to very carefully sort of leave out some big world historic things like slavery, the plague, civil wars, interstate wars, right? You've got to choose your, when you tell the sort of the anecdotal stories that sustain these analyses, you've got to pick your starting points very carefully. So we start the China story with Deng Xiaoping in 1978 and not with 1949, for example, or earlier. Here's my question. What would a theory of development look like that sets all that aside and begins with violence and extraction? And do you think it's true?
And we don't have Jotun for it.
So,
looters.
Yeah, well, so, but yeah, so it's a difficult question. I'm not sure exactly you are referring to contemporary period in general. So
I'm sorry,
I'm not sure about the question, so.
Feel free to rephrase it. I'm being a bit provocative intentionally, but feel free to rephrase it in the way that you think.
To me, like, violence is fundamental part of development, right? Yeah. So the argument I, you know, would make is basically that you have, you know, this is this question of endogeneity that haunts us, and so we, right, try to go back to think about, you know, to how to solve this would be to think about a world where there are no institutions and there is nothing but people running around with very, you know, underdeveloped or no technologies. And it is possible to show, I think, formally and then perhaps with some anthropological material that it's only they cooperate without a third party enforcing that cooperation because they live in a state of relative equality. Then if at the point where there is a where there is differentiation, precisely because of this technological change leads to, in combination with factor endowment, say, it leads to differentiation among these different individuals, that normally triggers violence. And it's not that they then, you know, sort of functionally decide to establish institutions to solve this problem. I think it's just that in the struggle between those that want to loot, those that are doing better, and the response sometimes of the, of, you know, defensive response of those that are being looted, that you get institutions. And who gets to govern these, you know, these, to set up these institutions really depends on these military technologies. So at the beginning, I think that violence was there. It's always there. And but you know, read my book. I feel bad about, you know,
I think the response from models is one thing you immediately learn is it's first best is not possible. Mm-hmm. So, Rustici, Benabiba Rustici, 1997, Benabuda, you know, there's this series of models in which people can grab. Yes, they produce and they save, invest, and grab. And immediately you find that first best is not sustainable because if somebody's doing too well, then the incentive for somebody else to try to grab it. But these models are very hard to write. I had some talented students who tried to write it with endogenous investment in military capacity, and it turns out they're just mathematically unpleasant. But that lesson, I'm sure, is true, that if people can grab somebody else's at any time, that precludes first best, and actually in some models even precludes second best.
Any last questions or comments before we close? No? Okay, please join me in thanking our panelists. They didn't know the questions in advance, so thank you very much for putting yourselves through this. We'll go directly to the close now. Fabio and Mael Pilar, why don't you come down? So this has been fantastic from my private and very biased point of view. I've enjoyed this enormously. This has been fantastic papers and very good presentations and excellent discussions. So thank you to all of you for coming. Thanks to the three institutions for making all of this possible. Let me tell you a couple of sort of bookkeeping things and one thing about the model in terms of going forward. Next year we're going to be in Bogota, and I'm going to hand it over to Mael Pilar and Fabio in a moment to tell you a little bit about that. But just in terms of mechanics, all the papers that were presented, the 25 papers that have been presented yesterday and today, in principle we'd like to make available on the web, and people have been live blogging, tweeting, or whatever the right term of art is, to Alberto and to Gideon and Karen, asking for access to these papers. So we're going to put them all up unless you'd not like us to put them up. And if not, tell us not, and we won't. We have no problem not doing it. But if we do not hear from you, then we'll just link them on the website program, which is already up. And this will happen in the next week or two, basically. So do let us know. And as they get published, you can let us know. And then we'll also, you know, provide the sort of proper bibliographical reference. What else? Okay, let me just quickly, Rob Boyd is giving the big public lecture, which is part of this event. It's going to be in a different room in the old theater, in the old building. So the LSE main entrance, you can get in through the back. We could all walk over there. It's at 6:30, or you can make your way later. But you go past the entry and the guard on the side and the main entrance of the LSE, and it's directly behind you, behind a red wall, and there'll be people there sort of guiding you in. For those of you who don't know, Rob Boyd is one of the godfathers, as Michael said yesterday, of the field of cultural evolution. He's a proper scientist, not a social scientist like me, but a proper scientist, an evolutionary scientist who's sort of helped to, with his co-author, helped to create the field of cultural evolution. And the lecture is related to his new book, which just came out. So I think it should be quite interesting. What else? I think. Yes, please. Alberto has, please.
Okay, so I just wanted to share with you, this is just a little bit, sending the challenge to Neandes. So I wanted to tell you a little bit about some of the things, I was keeping some tallies. So we have to do better in terms of women composition. We had about 30% in our first conference. We had even less in this one. Very, very slight. I mean, not statistically significant. But we have to do better on that. The second one is something about the composition of the topics. So we still have very similar amount of papers on human capital. We have papers on clientelism in the first conference that we did not have here. We had papers on land, more or less similar, fiscal capacity, urbanization, ethnicity, extraction. We had more on the Stanford conference. Rebellion, we had a lot in this one. Democracy was similar. In the Stanford conference, we had no papers on inequality, corruption, or growth. So this is kind of a little bit of the overlay. We had in the Stanford conference 7 papers on Colombia and 7 papers on Mexico, and then this little, Peru, China, Benin, and Germany kind of, little additional things. This time, I think we did great. 2 on Madagascar. 3 on Colombia, 4 on Mexico, 3 on the U.S., Germany, Chile, Egypt, Brazil, and then some China, and then some general papers on, Latin America broadly, the world, and 1 experiment done on Canadian students. Okay. The third thing is I've been tweeting all throughout the 2 days. Every one of you got a tweet with at least the most attractive graphic I could find to... I'm told that the tweets that don't have any graphics don't do well, so you have to put some image in them. And I have to tell you that the winner thus far right now, the last time I checked, but the ones who presented today will get more impressions, I'm sure. But right now, Omar's paper is doing really well. And I think some of it is because the graphics are just so visual and so attractive. So again, we have an audience looking at a paper on Madagascar. And maybe it's your followers, who knows? And the final thing is just to tell you, I think we have a very interesting model, not just because of the papers that were presented. I think that's obviously the richness of what we did, but the discussants truly outdid themselves in the kind of thing they did. This is kind of something that is very difficult to replace. We could put a repository with all the papers, and we could all read them, but doing what the discussants did, I think, was just incredible. So I wanted to kind of launch those to Los Andes. You are now in the driver's seat for next year.
So let me say a word about the model we have, because this is an invitation to volunteer or to think about good suggestions going forward. And the model is really something that Alberto and I stumbled upon. It was much more his idea than mine, but I think it was semi-accidental and very fortuitous. which is the three, and then Los Andes joined in fairly early in the game, very enthusiastically, which is why we're all going to Bogota next year. The three main universities, Stanford, LSE, and Los Andes, rotate in sponsoring it. Each base university finances its own academics participation. So Stanford paid for Stanford people and some others actually to come to London, for example. LSE paid for me and other LSE people to go to Stanford last year and so forth. But the place that's hosting it pays for everyone else and sort of, you know, lays on the hospitality and makes it happen, which means it is properly shared, and also that it's sustainable sort of into the long run going forward. So Los Andes will tell you in a minute about, you know, early plans for next year. There's no need for there to be, but there's currently no plan for what happens after Bogota. We could go back to Stanford maybe, or we could go somewhere else. So, you know, we've been speaking to various colleagues about possibilities of expanding. If your university is interested in joining, or if you have an idea for somewhere else you'd like to go, maybe we should all go to Tokyo. I don't know. I'm just explaining what's going on, and let us know about your ideas. And without any more blabbing from me, I hand it over to Fabio and Maril Pilar.
Okay, I'm just gonna say a few words about next year's conference. I think the conference is going to be more or less at the same time of the year than this was held. It's going to be
the week of May 21st to 25th.
Yeah, and that week from in the week from the 21st of May to 25th May, that is going to be, because it's the best time for us to have the conference, because the exams are finished and there are more rooms available. That's one thing. The other thing is that we are going to send you our emails in case that you have any idea or any suggestions about how the conference should be held, the topics that may be covered, the topics that may be introduced in the conference and so on, because I think that we need to do better in terms of have a broader topics or more narrow topics, but all the suggestions for major companies are going to be well received. All the people that do not belong to either to LSE or to Stanford are going to be invited by Los Andes. So I think we have a challenge of fundraising for this year, but I think that we are going to fulfill that challenge. I don't know if Maria Pilar, are you going to say something?
No, I mean, I think I just need this. I think we're very happy to organize the conference next year. I think that the bar has been set very high, but we promise a very interesting discussion next year. Just on a personal side, I want to make, I mean, all of you are very welcome to come to Colombia next year, but I want to actually make a special invitation to the people, to the professors, colleagues, and friends that are at LSE right now, that actually, you know, they helped me and they worked with me during the last 7 years. So I hope Jean-Paul for sure is going to be there next year. But Alejandra, where's the Devin, Felipe, Kathy left, John, I hope to see you next year. So if you can actually pencil down now the dates, so there are no problems next year.
And I think that's it. I think we're done. Thank you to all of you.